The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People Radio. Good afternoon, everybody. Bob.
Good afternoon, Aaron.
It's kind of bizarre. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm just messing with you.
I'm doing
okay,
great.
Okay, now Bill's got his little headphones on.
Yeah, I got my headphones on. I'm ready to roll. I think they're on backwards, though. I'm hearing my left side through my right side.
Yeah, like you would know.
Oh, there
okay,
we go.
Try it again.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
how's
much
that?
Better.
Is that good?
I was completely turned around. It was like I was looking out the back of my head.
Because, see, this is a cap on the environmentalist day, so you wouldn't want your left side on your right side.
No.
Because then we'd have to make fun of you. You'll fire it up with some good music for us, Bob?
Oh, you better believe it.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and speaking of global warming, I'm certainly happy we got global warming going on back east. Otherwise, those people would really be in a world of hurt.
Yeah, they'd be in deep, deep trouble.
Deep trouble.
It was on, what was the magazine? We just were at the grocery store, and there was was it National Geographic?
Yeah, National Geographic.
Yeah, yeah.
Said global warming is a fake.
It was all about junk science. It said global warming was fake. And
but
I'm like,
they also said that moonwalk was a fake,
too.
So I don't know.
Anyway, National Geographic's gone off the deep end.
National Geographic or the National Enquirer?
No, the Enquirer was on the other side of the aisle. On the other side was National Geographic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there were two young guys buying groceries. It took them like 20 minutes to buy three things, so we had plenty of time to read all this stuff in the line.
Hey, the important stuff.
Exactly. Right. So we should remind people
that they're a byproduct of Common Core math.
That's right. And George Clooney is dumping his 143-day newlywed. So he's available again.
The things we learn.
Oh, yeah.
We just wanted to get the groceries and get out. It was a lot harder than it seemed. So you can find us online. For the people that are already listening online, you know, they already know that, but it's wethepeopleradio.us. For the folks that are listening on the actual radio, I do hope you go to the website because next Sunday, March 1st, is our Technocracy Town Hall. This is a huge experiment.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah, huge experiment with Patrick Wood, the author of Technocracy Rising. And so we've been promoting this for about a month. There are people who have RSVP'd from all over the country and even some of William Kay's friends from Canada, apparently. I don't know where they are in Canada, somewhere in Canada. So we'll have a lot of folks on next week who have read the book. If you haven't read the book yet, really, really worth it. You can get it from the author. You probably get it faster than you would through Amazon, unless you have the secret two-day shipping or whatever.
Is that the one the drone's going to drop it off?
No, that's the one where you sign up for it because it says you don't have to stay a member of the something or other and you get two-day shipping. And then 30 days later, your credit card gets hit with this bill because you forgot to cancel it.
Bazinga.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
the old Columbia Record Club trick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So buy it from
there. That's Amazon Prime.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I did it one time, and I was like, what is this charge? Why do they keep charging me for this? Yeah, I was an idiot. It happens all the time. All right, so you can find all that stuff. It's right on the front page of the website. We made it really easy. You can find the Amazon link for the book, and you can also find the link to the author. And it says there's a big red thing, and it says click here to join the March 1st National Town Hall on Technocracy. So you don't have to RSVP, but it's fun if you do because Patrick's sitting at home refreshing his screen watching for how many people come in. He emailed me like three times in a half hour.
We got another one.
He's like 123, 124. I'm like, why don't you just wait until you hit like 130 or something? It's pretty funny. All right. So today we're talking with William Kay. Do we have his sound on? Is he in there?
Oh, he's been in there the whole time.
Oh, for Lord's sake.
Oh, I've been torturing him.
we make all our guests be our hostages. So let's see. The last time we talked to Mr. K was January of 2013. The environmentalists have done all sorts of bad things since then. So he's going to catch us up. His website is ecofascism.com. So that ought to pretty much let people know where we're headed. And I don't have really a bio on William. So, hey, William, why don't you tell him what you want him to know, if anything?
Oh, my personal history?
Well, we just have on there that, that you don't have anything.
For starters, I've got my immediate history is I have a bit of a cold, so I hope I don't come off as too raspy. Oh, my educational background, I have an advanced degree in literature and a law degree. I practiced law for a few years in Toronto and then moved on to other things. One of the things that I moved on to, I was doing a radio station in Vancouver, a radio show in Vancouver, and I got into doing a lot of stuff about global warming and the skeptical community around global warming, and this led to quite a kerfuffle. And after about 2 years, the environmental movement in British Columbia literally took over the station just to get me off the air. And at that point, I started doing the website, ecofascism.com. And that's, it's coming around 15, 16 years now, and I've been on the side doing this and reading as much as I could about the environmental movement. So I've been, actively studying this topic for over 20 years now.
And do you think it's getting better, worse, or the same?
Was it cooler?
Oh, it's getting much larger. It's not even a conventional social movement. This is basically a parallel government we have now. There are so many government agencies like the EPA that are basically environmental movement organizations. They are basically activist organizations. And there's a whole raft of them, and they operate at national levels and state and provincial levels as well. And if you sort of do the math about how big this movement is getting and how deeply they penetrated the governments, it's more ominous than most people are aware. There's been a lot of really good documents lately coming out. I'm certainly sensing it in the U.S. People are becoming far more aware of the nature and scope of the environmental movement, but at the same time, the environmental movement has the initiative. They are still moving forwards. We're sort of traipsing along behind them, just trying to figure out, what they are doing and who they are. But they're not at a point where they are the de facto government. But they're on the road to that.
Well, because they can make assertions about science that are just completely nutty. And because they say, no, that's what the science is. The science is settled. They tell us all the time the science is settled. Well, when do you ever have settled science? If we had settled science, we would still be, the sun would still be orbiting us. Science, we learn new things.
What we're getting into here is, the sociology of scientific knowledge. The environmental movement has co-opted entire branches of academia, most particularly climatology and atmospheric physics and what have you. And this was a process that took, 30 years for them to achieve. But effectively, there are 98% or 97%, I would estimate, of professional climatologists now basically on the payroll of the movement. And that is how you get this notion that there's a consensus that global warming is real,
et cetera.
But it's more of a ground strategy of taking over and co-opting various faculties with a huge wave of money. And that gives you, an enormous choir of people with PhDs after their names to claim something to be the truth. Well, let's put this out very clearly, that the notion of human-caused catastrophic global warming isn't a dubious proposition. It's a ridiculous proposition. It's ridiculous that anyone could speak with any certainty about that topic.
Yeah, but now you're a nut if you don't go along with it. Now
it's getting
got you
better.
So outnumbered.
Well, now it's costing people money, though. See, that's going to be the deal breaker, because now they want everybody to pay for it. And here comes the big redistribution of wealth, which is the whole point of global warming. And once that hits people in the wallet, they're like, hey, wait a minute. We don't think that's – I don't know what I think about that. Now people are starting to question. Kind of late, but –
Well, people were questioning it at the very beginning. In fact, at the very beginning of the campaign, much of the old guard of climatologists, people like Hubert Lam and, Michael Lindzen, people like that, were very skeptical. And these were the leading figures within academic climatology. They've all been swept aside. There's always been skepticism. There's never been anything approaching consensus. And it's always been hitting people in the wallet, although it's likely to do that more so I mean, people don't realize the scale of global warming. I read a recent posting that estimated that the global warming budget, you know, the climate change campaign budget, if you factor in all the money that is going into renewable energy right now, globally, is probably $1 billion a day. And that sounds like some wild exaggeration, but it really isn't. The UNEP, the United Nations Energy Environment Program, puts out annual calculations as to how much money is going into renewable energy, by which they define as wind power, solar power, biofuels, etc. They don't count large-scale hydro dams. This is just basically wind and solar power and ethanol, etc. They put last year's gross expenditures at about $215 billion. That's how much is going into building wind turbines and solar parks, etc. So it's a vast enterprise at this point. And it explains, you know, with that kind of money, how they can influence the media and influence academia as well.
Well, their influence is far-reaching. I mean, they touch everything, it seems like, anymore, from car manufacturing to the food we eat has got somehow it's touching global warming.
Yeah. Well, you know, now they've got, you know, now they're on a big anti-meat deal because, you know, cows cause global warming. So our dependence on fossil fuel and our obsession with animal products is what's ruined the planet now.
Well, sure it is.
I saw that recently the U.S. federal government issued new dietary guidelines, and they're incorporating sustainable development into the dietary guidelines.
Yeah,
and I'm, you know, someone who's always been arguing with vegans and vegetarians, it proves my point that these people are altering their diet not for nutritional reasons. They're doing it for ideological reasons.
Well, obviously it's not for nutritional reasons because if you look at the vegans, they don't even look healthy.
I know. They look like something that came out of that, you know, Area 51 Roswell thing.
They do. They look a little pasty. I don't think they're getting
there is kind of that weird gray color. But they'll be easy to control, all us meat eaters. Us meat eaters, we'll take them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So we need to take a really quick break, and then we'll come right back.
Regroup.
Yeah, we're gonna eat some mint.
Fortify the lines.
We're going to eat some mints to get the meat taste out of our mouth.
Just trying to follow the logic there. If they want us to get rid of the cows, they should be encouraging us to eat meat like crazy.
Well, true.
You know, that's an excellent point. I have to bring that up at the next public meeting. That'll be annoying.
More flawed logic.
I'll bring my copy of National Geographic. Yeah. All right. You're listening to We the People Radio. Find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with William Kay for the entire 2 hours. We're talking about we'll just call it environmental nuttiness, and his website is ecofascism.com. Be right back with you here at KCNR 1460 AM. Welcome back to We the People Radio. We are joined by William Kay this weekend. William, where do you live in Canada again? Is it by Toronto?
I've lived in almost every city in Canada. At present, I am in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, okay. I just was curious. Are you on the left side or the right side?
What?
Of Canada. You know, my geography was, you know, I was looking for some fairly broad geography.
I didn't know there was a left and right. There's an east and west. This is a western province.
Ah, okay.
It is due north of Montana.
Nice. So you're mostly in our time zone.
It's Mountain Time Zone.
You're north.
I don't know.
North of Calgary.
Something about being in Utah.
He's in Elizabeth Time
having
Zone.
Having some sort of Utah connection these days. I don't know where you are physically now, but
we're in Northern California, so we're in a Pacific Time. We were just laughing about the global warming thing because we do that a lot. But I had since I was at the grocery store, trapped in the thing, you know, where you're waiting to check out, and they have all the mints there. I got myself a selection of mints here. I thought I'd try out some different kinds since I don't chew gum. And we found these Altoids Arctic mints. They are it says they're curiously cool. Seriously, they clear out your sinuses and all the people around you, their sinuses too.
They cure global
and
warming.
They could
think.
Seriously
yeah.
take down global warming.
Yeah,
I think
crush them up.
Yeah. I think aerosolize
them. There's no measured global warming for about 18 years now. We've hit a sort of a climate plateau, despite what a lot of headlines have
been. Yeah, why don't we hear more about that?
Well, it's the power of the environmental movement once again. They are very good at getting their stuff through the media. It's because the owners and operators of a lot of the mainstream media are wholly part of this program.
Yeah, and they're still claiming
even
that
the main temperature recording stations around the world. There's only three or four of them that make some effort to determine, you know, the average global temperature of the planet, which really isn't that important in the first place. But they are admitting, and these guys are warming alarmists, they are admitting there's been no appreciable warming since the late 1990s.
Yeah, and I just heard last week on the radio that last year was the warmest year in the history of the planet or some stupid thing.
That headline was broadcast around the world, that 2014 was the warmest year on record.
Yeah.
It is not true. It is not true even by the statistics coming out of the Climate Research Unit, et cetera. If you look closer at it, they're saying that there was a 38% likelihood that it might have been the warmest year on record. And then they started saying that it was warmer than the previous record by less than 0.02 of a degree Celsius.
That's my same chances of winning the lottery.
Even less Fahrenheit. And that's 1/10 of their own stated margin of error. So there really wasn't a story there at all, yet it's a tribute to the power of that political movement that a non-story, no broken records, was broadcast right around the world.
Isn't that amazing? And that they can just broadcast whatever they want and all the news agencies just pick it up and run with it.
And if you say it enough, it makes it true. So I was looking at your website and I thought maybe we should explain it a little more. I mean, that just the first line. The purpose of the website is to expose both the similarities between environmentalism and fascism and the connection between environmentalism and modern fascistic or arch-conservative individuals and groups. That's kind of a big goal.
Well, it's a very important point that I don't think I'll ever tire of trying to point out to people that there is a even amongst the skeptics, even amongst the people who are pretty much wise to what is going on with environmentalism and all the junk science, there's a tendency to portray it as a far left-wing movement. And the leading ideologues within the environmental movement want that perception. They want to be perceived as being a far left movement. But this movement has its historical roots, and its current tendencies are really fascism, which is a movement of the extreme right. It gets complicated. I will just, out of the back of my brain, quote something from William Safire's Dictionary of Political Terms, and that in the United States, up until the 1930s, a liberal was someone who believed in capitalism. A liberal was someone who wanted limited government and laissez-faire economics. During FDR's presidency, the Democratic Party appropriated the term liberal unto themselves. The leader of the Republican Party referred to it as one of the greatest cons in the history of America. So it really confuses the situation, because if you do a historical look at this political movement, it was referred to as conservative up until the recent era. And now they're claiming to be liberal, but I agree with the late Michael Crichton in his last book about, you know, global warming, is that to call these people liberal is a cruel joke. They're really fascists. These are ultra-statists. They want to regulate virtually all aspects of the economy. They are not, in any stretch, in a conventional sense of the term, economic liberals. So it really muddies the water, the phrase liberal and conservative, as do the phrases left-wing, right-wing.
Yeah.
Fascist movements, there are exceptions to this rule. But generally, during the fire last time, most fascist movements masqueraded as left-wing movements. They claimed to be representing working people and the poor and the downpressed, what have you. In reality, almost virtually every fascist movement has been a movement of a section within the inherited elite. These are, you know, the princes, the plutocrats, the oligarchs. They never represented all of that constituency, but it was that set of the population that formed the nucleus of the fascist movement and that forms the nucleus of the environmental movement. It is not a grassroots movement. In spite of all, you know, go to the Sierra Club and you'll see all these videos of persons of color, you know, pumping their fists in the air. That's a complete illusion. The environmental movement represents some of the wealthiest people in the world.
Yeah, you won't get any argument there. I mean, just
no.
Look at it.
Well, you look at who's bankrolling it.
Exactly.
But it does.
What came out recently, this is a real breakthrough document, and it came out from the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works, the Minority Staff Report, the Chain of Environmental Command. And it's how a club of billionaires and their foundations control the environmental movement and the Obama's EPA. And it's really a breakthrough document because it's coming from, you know, leaders within the Republican Party. And they are explicitly saying that, you know, that the environmental movement in the U.S., is, you know, centered around, you know, several dozen of these billionaire families, you know, the Rockefellers, the Pugh family, et cetera. Typically, they are inheritors. These are people who are second and third generation super rich.
Old money.
That is the, you know, social location out of which environmentalism comes. And, the, you know, most people are unaware of that. Some of us have been saying that for 20 years. So it is a real breakthrough to see it coming from the Republican Party. It shows that they are wisening up to the nature of this movement. Yet even that document insists, I actually counted, on 67 occasions they referred to the environmental movement as a far-left movement. You know, the traditional radical left, capital L left, was a movement that advocated, you know, expropriating the fortunes of these old dynasties.
Right.
So it seems kind of ridiculous to think that, you know, these families, the Rockefellers, et cetera, are running a campaign to do that, and they certainly are not. You know, the way I like to think of it is if you're juggling two balls, you're not really juggling at all. You take, you know, you need to get three or four things in the air before you're juggling. Most people have a hard time. They want to see left and right. They want, you know, polarity of two different opinions. In reality, there's three opinions here. There is a traditional radical left. It is pretty much extinguished in the English-speaking world. It's pretty much an insignificant political movement. But the real struggle is between those who believe in what was formerly called economic liberalism and this other force which wants a highly regulated society and a highly regulated economy. But they are definitely not people who are advocating any sort of radical egalitarian or leveling agenda. No, this is a group of sort of, you know, well-heeled, old money, big money elements from New York that have a very much a different vision for America than the vast majority of Americans do, and who are utterly contemptuous of the common people. And they really, at a fundamental level, do not believe in democracy. If you get right into sort of fascist ideology, you'll see all kinds of quotes like, you know, that basically the population are just too stupid to understand economic policy and foreign policy, so why are we even asking for their opinion? You know, they want a government that's sort of run by the elites, for the elites, and you know, the broader masses could be utterly excluded from the process.
Well, aren't
if you watch what the EPA is doing in groups like that, they're basically doing that.
Sure.
They're setting government policy entirely without any input from Congress.
And these are the same folks that are actually touting population control, and I think you can see why when you go down this road.
Well, it's all about control. Let's have the little 250 square foot house because that's all you need, and you don't need a car. You can live right on a metro line, and you can just eat lettuce and some. We'll throw you some cabbage and stuff every now and then, and bottom line is don't step out of line because we don't really need you that much. You can just go to your little job that we're going to figure out for you during Common Core. You go make your little widgets, and there's your life. That's it.
Bingo. It's a form of ensurfment. But keep in mind, the people who are promoting this, you know, Al Gore and Prince Charles, they are not living that lifestyle.
No, and they're never going to.
Oh, absolutely not.
The part that I guess craziness you can never get wrap your mind around, otherwise you're crazy too, but I can never figure out how people don't see it coming for them. The nuts and berries don't they realize they're enslaved too?
Well, the certain elements within the elite are thriving off this. Many people benefit economically from environmentalism. I'll give you one example. This is a movement that has a mass base. It is not some tiny little conspiracy.
No.
The best example in America is the whole ethanol scam.
Yeah.
You know, right now half of the American corn crop is being used to produce ethanol. It's an entirely redundant fuel. It's less volatile than gasoline. There's no economic or market reason to be mixing it with gasoline. Yet there's a lot of farmers in America who are enjoying greatly inflated prices for their product. We're basically buying half the harvest and burning it. We're buying it at market rates. There's a lot of other people in America, notably the livestock producers, are very upset about this because their feedstock for their product is going way up because of this. But it's not as though these farmers are not, the corn farmers and the ethanol farmers are not benefiting from this. They are benefiting handsomely from this. So there is a mass base to this. And it's more than anything else. You know, the issue is about land. Few of the skeptics, really truly grasp this. But what a lot of the elite, wherever their fortunes came from, a lot of these people, the Rockefellers are the prime example. The fortunes came from petroleum. It came from industry, what have you. But as the dynasties mature, they increasingly transfer their assets to urban real estate, government bonds, things like that. They step away from the actual management of businesses, and they move into more of a rentier position. And it's the landed interest, particularly the people who own the land in the built-up metropolitan areas of the Northeast, and in Southern California, places like that. Just do sort of a mind experiment and, contemplate, what is the value of the land from Boston down to Baltimore? That little strip of land there, New York and New Jersey and all those places, they're fully built up areas. that land is worth, trillions of dollars. And it generates hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue every year. The people who, the primary owners of that land do not want to see, they do not want to see the hinterlands of America thrown open for development. This would simply lead to an outward migration out of the areas that they control. Most businesses in America are tenants. They do not own the premises out of which they operate. If they had an opportunity to build their own, if land was cheap enough, they would move out. The history of American environmentalism, begins with things like the Adirondack Parks. There was an outward migration of people from New York City into the Adirondacks, and the burghers of New York City got together, and they put a complete stop to that, and they turned it into a giant park where no one could settle. And this was a way to contain people within the areas that they controlled and owned. William Rockefeller, in 1905, bought a small town in the Adirondack Parks. He burned every house to the ground, and he was hailed as a hero of the wilderness by Collier Magazine. That was in 1905. And,
wow.
We mentioned Utah earlier.
Hold that thought, William. We've got to squeeze in a really quick break here. See, this is stuff that people just don't know. And we'll be talking about it for a couple hours here with Mr. K. We'll be back with you. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Rennie.
it's so hard to please. Look around.
He said, son, I know at your age, seems like this old world is turning slow. And you think you'll find the answer to it all, where corn don't grow. Hard times are real.
The ethanol song.
Growing petroleum, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, like we don't have enough petroleum. We have to make it out of corn.
Yeah. Well, you know, we wouldn't want to.
It's an outrage, you know, that in a hungry world that we're burning that much food. It's absolutely unnecessary that we're doing that. And it's happening in Canada as well and other places in the world. It's an absolute outrage. It's one of the worst crimes of the environmental movement, and they have many crimes to account for. The fact that they are burning that much food is one of the worst.
Well, the first show this year we did with a gal about the egg thing. And so here they came up with this brilliant idea that chickens needed all this extra room. Well, because of that, they wound up having to kill, I don't know, what was it? You guys remember 30% of the laying hens in California?
It was in California.
It was zillions of them because they can't take them out of this bioregion. And we don't have any facilities inside the bioregion where you can make dog food or anything else. You couldn't even use them. You couldn't eat them. You couldn't turn them into dog food. You couldn't do anything. They just had to landfill them.
Yeah, that's, you know, add that to the litany of crimes of the environmental movement. So I want to make a few more points
about
this land thing. California, 45% of the land is owned by the U.S. federal government. Virtually the entire eastern half of the state is owned by the U.S. federal government, and they've taken it out of development. And if you look at the map of where the federal lands are, you get down south between, you know, what they call San Francisco to San Diego. It's not too far inland from there, and it's all public lands, all sitting there idle. If they, you know, do a thought experiment about what would happen if they sold those lands at a fast auction. You know, whatever level of government sold it would gain, you know, probably $1 trillion. But you would see a dramatic out-migration from the San Francisco-San Diego area up into the new lands, where land would be super cheap. And, of course, that would not bode well to the big landlords from the, you know, Los Angeles area, et cetera. So all these alligator tears they cry about these, you know, great lands and these ecosystems and the majestic animals, et cetera, is really a ruse to restrict the amount of land available. You know, people tell me, you know, they think the environmental movement began in the 1960s. They say it began in the 60s. I say, do you mean the 1860s? You know, the environmental movement was existing in a clearly recognizable form in the 1860s. The science of ecology emerges in Germany at that time, and it was primarily a way to prevent land from being opened up to regular market relations, regular capitalist relations. The aristocracy of Germany was terrified. If we really had capitalism in land, the value of their land would plummet. Ecology was a way to terrorize people into thinking that, you know, if you make the slightest modification of the wilderness, you know, all manner of evil will spring forward. You'll have, you know, too many insects and you won't have enough rain, etc. All of these sort of myths about, you know, the damages that could be caused by unrestrained capitalism emerge in the 1860s in Germany. But what has remained central to the environmental movement is that land cannot be treated as any other commodity. We cannot have a sort of capitalist market in land. One of the upshots of doing that, if we did do that, and we did do it in the late 19th century, would be that the price of land would fall precipitously. And there's winners and losers when that happens. And the losers would be those who own big blocks of metropolitan areas. They would end up seeing their value of their assets collapse or shrink dramatically. There'd be a lot of boarded up buildings. There'd be a lot of rents being sliced in half, etc. That is what they are trying to prevent when they are blocking the development of the hinterland, amongst other things.
Well, you talk about the federal government owning land. The largest landowner in California is the state of California. And not to mention that the federal and state land, none of that's on the tax rolls. What about that? What about, all the money that they could be collecting if this land was privately held?
Well, and where we are, tons of timber, lots of mining available. We have a lot of water. We really do have a lot of water resource that can be used for hydro, but they don't count any of our hydro, as you mentioned at the beginning of the hour. So we do have access to all these things that could make our economy go, but we're locked out from all that. Can't use it. They've cut off all the mining, all the suction dredge mining in California. They cut off.
And the logging. Look at all the logging.
Most people know about timber, but they don't know about the mining. And
there's oil and gas, and there's all sorts of other opportunities that would emerge. I mean, there'd be agricultural opportunities.
Sure.
There'd be settlement opportunities.
You're not going to build your house out of corn stalks.
Yeah.
You got to build your house out of oil.
Not only are they not gaining revenue from those lands, it's costing, the taxpayers a lot of money to manage these lands. We can't just have wilderness. These hills and swamps just can't be there. You've got to have, park service officials and biologists and all these other people, mucking around in there trying to manage this wilderness. It's an economic drag, an economic drain, keeping it as wilderness.
Well, a dirty little secret a lot of people don't know in California is a lot of these public lands are actually managed by the Sierra Club. These environmental organizations, and you're not allowed to go on that land. Even though we paid for it, you keep off because we're going to save that for the
Nature
for the birds.
Conservancy it. Oh, and then they're constantly going around trying to talk some farmer or rancher into putting their land into some sort of trust, land trust,
conservancies,
right?
Yeah.
Conservancies, yeah.
It's brutal. But I was just at a cattleman's dinner last night up in the hinterland, as you call it, and their entire program at their dinner was about how they speak about their industry. And people were talking, it was their speaker, topic was, how are you talking to your kids about agriculture? Because a lot of people's kids don't want to come back and run the farm. And the parents don't want them to either, because a lot of times they don't think they can make a living. So they're being driven out, and, it's interesting to watch these folks, because they, the one lady sitting next to me, she goes, what are people going to eat? And that's the part that the environmentalists just don't address.
No, they don't care. They seriously don't care about that.
Correct. Look at the environmental movement, it's quite a layer cake. The people at the bottom levels, the activists that would be employed by local environmental groups and et cetera, those people are usually quite clueless as to what the overall agenda is. However, at the lower levels, you'll find these almost people with a religious commitment to, to Mother Nature and what have you, that you wouldn't find at the higher levels as well. But yeah, it's, key to the environmental movement is a realization that at the higher levels, you do have these Malthusians, these people who do firmly believe the world is overpopulated, or that is how they're going to rationalize their policies, because they really don't want that many people around in the first place.
It's almost two different agendas. One agenda is coming from the bottom, and one of them's being controlled from the top.
It's a mercenary movement. Most of the people at the bottom, this is their job. I don't know. I've gone over countless biographical blurbs about people who work in various environmental organizations. And America right now has about 25,000 environmental activist organizations. I couldn't figure out how many employees they've got. But when you read the biographical blurbs about these people, it's always how they're passionate about the wilderness and they're passionate about nature, etc. They're passionate about collecting their paycheck. And part of doing that is going along with the party line. And the party line isn't that, we're keeping this land out of reasons, out of development for political economic reasons. The party line is that we're keeping this land out of development, so that Mother Nature and wilderness can carry on. with that, you know, at the higher levels, that that is not the case. I was reading the history of one of the leading founders of parks across America. He was a guy who lived in New York City. The only park he ever set foot in was Central Park in New York City. He didn't even go there very often. You know, a lot of the people who are really the architects of the park system, these aren't wilderness lovers. These are people who go to the opera. They think the wilderness is a bore, and so do I. But so there's different levels of consciousness within the movement. But at the core,
classic.
You know, it's those people who they really want a highly regulated government, and under no circumstance do they want to see land in general thrown open to the market. And in doing so, they are running completely, you know, diametrically against what the founding fathers of America wanted. You know, the Puritans, you know, you got off the boat, you got 160 acres, you got a Bible and an axe. They moved forward just creating new township after new township. They had no idea, you know, to preserve the wilderness to them would be ridiculous, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that spirit more or less waned until, you know, in the 1820s, 1830s, it was pretty much gone. Then after the Civil War, Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, they threw the West open for development again. They had the big railway grants and other grants like that. You know, the railways in Canada and three in the States were given 10 miles either side of the track, half of all that land in payment for building the railways across the continent. And so they were left with all this land, and they went to Europe, and they solicited farmers from Europe to come over to America, and they came over in the millions. And the European aristocrats watched this with great chagrin. You know, these were their farmers, their tenants were fleeing to America because, you know, Lincoln offered these European immigrants 160 acres, no money down. All you had to do was get some sort of farm up and running within a certain number of years, and they would give you the title. You know, this was a dream come true for a lot of European immigrants. Certainly the part of the world I live in was entirely populated by the descendants of those people, the homesteaders and what have you. They could do that again in America. You're sitting on that much land. You know, the U.S. federal government alone is sitting on 1 million square miles of land that they are sitting idle. The one other host is right on. The state governments themselves are massive landowners. And then there's all these private conservancies. I've yet to see anyone actually sit down and do the math how much land in America is being taken out of production by this movement and by these governments.
You know, that's
but
a really
game changer in terms of the economy.
That's a great point. I think if these folks that live in the city would come to some of these rural areas and just drive up in the woods, drive out in the country, and look at how many thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of trees and wilderness there is, I think they'd have a little different view. I mean, we're not running out of land. We're not running out of trees either. We're not running out of any of that. I mean, there's just tons of it out there that is just being locked away from us.
Hmm. You know, if you look at the, you know, North America, because I'm in Canada, everything we could say about, you know, unused land in the States, you can multiply it by 10 in Canada. Canada actually has a larger land mass than the United States, including Alaska.
And what, a 10th of
the population?
And we have a population
about the size of California.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a big, vast, empty space. But there's people here who are convinced that it's overpopulated. There's too many people. It's utterly ridiculous. You could put, you know, the entire population of China in the province that I'm living in. The state of Montana is bigger than Germany. Germany has almost 90 million people. Montana has 1 million.
Right, right. Oh, it's mind-boggling. I know when I was much younger, I took a trip up to Canada, and we were up in the wilderness someplace. We climbed to the top of this mountain, and it was out of Banff or someplace up there. But from the top of that mountain, as far as you could see in every direction was trees. Just thousands of acres of trees. There was no roads. There was no towns. There was, you know, it was just absolute wilderness as far as you could see. And yet they think we're going to run out of trees. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, trees are a renewable resource. You know, people need to know that a tree is not an immortal creature.
No.
They don't live forever.
What? Haven't
if we
you
don't
seen
harvest them
video?
And turn them into wood, they burn down, they rot, they fall over, what have you. You know, saving a tree is ridiculous. It is not a sentient being. It is a plant.
You know, I was speaking to a logger a couple of weeks ago who bought interests in a plantation, tree plantation in Fiji. And they actually, he told me that that a forester in Fiji can actually oversee the harvest of three generations of timber on the same property. That's how fast the trees grow there. And it's kind of this, they don't grow quite that fast here in America, but two harvests are not uncommon at all. Cut down, grow, cut down again, and it's growing again in your lifetime. I mean, they are totally renewable.
Here we just burn it up.
We let it catch on fire with forest fires.
Hey, we've got to jump off here so we can. I guess we got to hear the news. We have to find out. We have to find out all the bad stuff that's happened in the last hour. Well, we've been chatting with Mr. K. We're going to come back. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us. Join us on the chat room too. It's really quiet in there. It's just Bill and I and Bob. So. Chat room link is right there as well. And next week is the National Town Hall on Technocracy link, also on the front page. Hit it, Bob. Welcome back. You've joined Read the People for the second hour. Oh, there we go. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us. Bill.
Aaron.
Bob.
Aaron. Jackson.
So we're all good for the second hour. We are joined by our guest up in Canada. His name is William Kay. You can find out very little about him, but he's online, and he's got a great website. That's where you really want to go, ecofascism.com. It's a great site. There's a ton of information. You've had it for how long? 18? Did you say 18 years, William?
Oh, stand by. Oh. Now it should sound much better.
The part where we turn the sound on. Okay, are you there now?
Yep.
Oh, there we go. Okay, so how long have you had the website up? It's like 18 years.
It has been about 15 years.
15, because, I mean, you have articles about everything on here. There's a ton of information. If you were going to send...
Well, I've been very lazy lately. I've been doing lots of reading, but I have not been nailing my ass to the chair and getting some more stuff posted. It happens. First time in my life I've really experienced writer's block, but one of the ways I get out of doing any writing is I just read more, and I can rationalize that this reading somehow is going to materialize in a new posting. I'll tell you, one of the things that I read recently, which was extremely good, was a document that there's a group in the States, they're enviro skeptics, called the Energy and Environment Legal Institute. And they put out a report about improper collusion between the EPA and green groups. People should really take a look at that. One of the things they talk a lot about there is the revolving door. All throughout the EPA, and the EPA has about 17,000 employees now, you find people who worked for several years for the Sierra Club or the Environmental Defense League, then they get jobs in the EPA. And that is certainly true of the entire leadership of the EPA. Literally hundreds of people, and if you look at their bios, it's back and forth from leading environmental groups like the Nature Conservancy, then they get jobs in the EPA for several years, then they go back to another environmental group like that. You can really see a fusion between, you know, the elite environmental groups and the EPA.
Oh, big
And the group
time.
That put out that report did a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests, and they dredged up quite a number of really incriminating emails from these groups. And it's clear that, you know, they view themselves as being entirely at one with the various environmental groups that they cooperate with, and they work together continuously. Well, you know, there are emails where leading executives from environmental groups chastise EPA members for not putting out the kind of propaganda the way they want them to do it. And a lot of EPA officials live in fear that there's going to be these phone calls from leading environmental groups to their bosses, you know, saying that they want things done this way or that way. So that's it's an important point. And what they don't develop in that report, because they're really just focusing on the EPA, is that relationship exists not just between the EPA and all these green groups, but but also the Fish and Wildlife Services, the Park Services, and at the state level, you've got the same thing going on. And the environmental movement has been around for so long, and it has been big for so long. We now have an entire corpse of people who are have been working in this movement in various government bureaucracies or the EPA or the, you know, the Sierra Club and what have you for 30 to 40 years. Like some of these people, they've known no other career job. They've been working with Big Green for 40 years.
Well, and some of them, what I'm finding is some of these people have worked on the same project their whole life. Like just for instance, I got a little example here. Shasta Dam. They've been talking. Bureau of Reclamation has been kicking on and off, you know, should we raise Shasta Dam so we can hold back more water? Well, they want to get rid of everybody else's dam, but they want to raise that one. But it's going to wreck a town, and it's going to impact a bunch of other stuff. Well, I went to this meeting about that a few months ago, and I guess I didn't really realize this, but they've been working on that, the idea, for 34 years. 34 years! People started with the Bureau of Reclamation and retired by now, and they still didn't get that thing off the starting block.
That was their sole project.
That's all they ever did their whole life.
Was work on information on raising the dam.
And nothing ever happened.
Hmm.
Oh, my
God. That's a really good anecdote there, and I'm sure you could repeat that many times over. I've noticed that as well. Yeah, like several years, they're grinding away on the same thing. I mean, what really is there to be done?
Yeah.
On a day-to-day basis, I'm not sure.
Yeah, what would you do for 34 years on the same stinking project? Lake Elmenor, same deal. It's 90 feet deep. It's not real deep for a lake. And they want to take the cold water out of the bottom of the lake so that fish 40 miles downstream will have cooler water. What? And they're trout. So who gives a crap? They're trout, right? We'll eat all you want. We'll make more. And in the lake, if they take that cold water out of the lake, it's going to kill the trout in the lake. But the trout 40 miles downstream where the sun will shine and it warm the water back up and it won't be cold anymore, they're more important. So we got to take that. That's over 10 years they've been working on that.
Hmm. Well, they're waiting for global warming to kick in to it'll be worthwhile.
You can't make this. Yeah. There should be some kind of punishment, you know? All right, if your project doesn't get done by this amount of time, you're out. Your project's dead.
William, wasn't the EPA busted here a year or so ago? With putting out faulty numbers regarding
everything.
Regarding CO2 emissions, their science was flawed, and I think they had to. Didn't they have to admit that?
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm trying to recall off the top of my head. There's been that sort of thing has happened a number of times. I don't recall. There's a lot of talk about particulate matter. Excuse me.
Oh, that's right.
You know, the dust and what have you. There are some good papers about that recently. There's one unbelievable story about this guy named Beale, who for 2 years convinced the leaders of the EPA that he was actually a CIA agent.
That's right, I forgot about that guy.
$200,000 a year from the EPA. But the report about him was he was one of these career guys again, a pathological liar, as was his boss at the EPA. Cooked up all kinds of stories about him having malaria and him being a Vietnam War vet, and all of this was mythological, and it was an excuse for him to get all sorts of bonuses from the EPA. He was literally making $200,000 a year,
but he was taking time off because he never actually retired. Yeah,
he was the guy. Him and his boss were the guys that came up with the initial particulate matter regulations, which really extended the EPA powers, and they prevent companies from emitting basically dust and smoke and what have you. But it was entirely falsified science, and they've never released the basic scientific data upon which these regulations have been made. And they are using that, the conclusions of that data to found dozens of other regulatory initiatives. Other congressmen are trying to get a law passed saying that the federal government cannot rely on any scientific report unless they produce the basic data underlying that report. Even after the passage of that law, the EPA is refusing to reveal the underlying data. And the architects of that entire initiative around particulate matter are Beale and his buddy Brenner, and they are just obviously
frauds.
Fundamentally dishonest people.
Right, right. Well, they had the same problem in California. The main architect of some of the CARB regulations was supposed to have a doctorate and some.
Yeah, he was the guy who wasn't even a real scientist.
He didn't even have a degree, but did they reverse any of his findings or reverse any of the laws that they implemented? Nope.
Oh, and better yet, he still works there. They didn't even get rid of him. He's still there pushing the regulation that he invented with his fake science degree. So,
wow.
So, you know, if we can figure this out, I mean, not to say that we're not smart people, but, you know, if we can figure this out and other people can figure this out, how the heck do we kick this through the uprights and you know, somehow get back on track?
Well, you have to
how do we do that?
Start with the realization that, you know, the corruption is flowing from the top down here. The media itself is deeply co-opted into this agenda, as are the universities. And
yeah,
so that's part
true.
Of the problem. It's not so much a matter of, you know, being right. It's the fact that they control the commanding heights of culture. And they are not interested in the truth. They have this agenda that they are pushing through. The sad, and most dangerous fact is that the environmental movement is an international movement. It's not headquartered in the United States. It's really, if it has a headquarters at all, it's in Europe and other places like that. And their agenda is definitely not in the interest of the United States. Their vision of the United States is a vast hinterland, is an economic basket case. That's their vision of the United States. The main thing is, you know, what do we do about it is, you know, expose and oppose. You know, there's good things happening in Utah right now. There's a real push at the government level to have the federal government transfer to Utah the federal lands. And that's two-thirds of the land in Utah is owned by the federal government. And they passed laws in the state, and they're making a push, and they're making a fuss to get control of those lands.
You think they'll do
it? So there is a fight back. We really have to use the media, and you have to use alternative medias and the internet and what have you. Don't expect to ever change the minds of people at NBC or people at the BBC or what have you. They are, you know, the old adage that, you know, the elites, it isn't as though they're ill-informed and well-intentioned. No, they're very well-informed. They're ill-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to make sure that we're not trying to change the minds of people whose job it is to put this propaganda out.
Yeah.
Have you ever had an argument with some sort of a university prof in climatology, what have you? You get the sort of, you know, telltale stare. You know, they know that what they're putting out is false propaganda, but this is their job, and it's the job of all their colleagues. So you're not, you know, there's a famous quote by Upton Sinclair that if a man's job, excuse me, I've got this cough, if his job depends on putting out a certain point of view, don't think you're going to change him. So you got to work with the people who are the victims of environmentalism. And that is primarily, you know, the business community, you know, the resource extraction community, the construction industry. The victims of environmentalism vastly outnumber the beneficiaries of environmentalism.
I was going to say, you don't have to look very far to find victims of the environmental agenda.
No, we're swimming in it. Oh, here we go again. We need to take a quick break. We're already tardy, which means they all pile up at the end. So you go have a drink of water and cough a lot, Mr. K. We'll be back
with
you.
Okay, I will do that.
We'll be back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Don't forget, we have our national town hall on technocracy next week. The ad is on the front page of the website. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. Now for the Bible, now for the flag, now for the word.
Kudos to the DJ. He's on the beat, that guy.
That's why we love being on Sunday, because we get Bob. which means we get specific music to each program, see, and that makes it more fun. I mean, we were just laughing during the break. It's like, how nice is it? Just a Sunday afternoon, you know, hang out, talk crap about the environmentalists. It's so relaxing. We just could have had a beer.
More people should do it. Yeah, it's therapeutic.
It's true. If we could just have had a beer or something, you know, this would just be great. Or a campfire.
Well, I'm not a drinking person, so you have to...
I said, or a campfire. You could bring the campfire. Well, you know, I mean, you could have...
Well, campfires are harmful to your health.
Well, there you go.
That's why we need it.
Breathing in all that smoke.
Lots of carbon.
That's why
there.
We need it. Beer and campfires.
Well...
Or have another hit of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly.
Well, we had a great guy. We just re-aired his show. His name's Leighton Stewart, and he's just the greatest guy. And he had told us on one of the shows, he's like, okay, if carbon dioxide was a pollutant, he goes, you know, we breathe like 400 parts per million. He goes, if you breathe into somebody else, like you're doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, that's 40,000 parts per million. So if carbon dioxide was a pollutant, we would have killed every person we ever did mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on. It's like...
Very good point.
How great is that? That's all the science I needed to know. I was all done then.
Well, carbon dioxide is the gas of life. It is the source of plant food. There would be no life on Earth at all without carbon dioxide. If carbon dioxide levels were falling, we should be worried. They're rising. That's a good thing. You know, I don't know if you what the economy runs on down there, but in British Columbia, the economy runs on marijuana grow operations.
Oh,
and these guys regularly pump carbon dioxide into their grow ops to increase the plant growth speeds. carbon dioxide is the gas of life. It is an essential part of the atmosphere. It has always been part of the atmosphere. To call it pollution is like calling oxygen pollution. It is utterly harmless, and it's by no means established that human emissions of carbon dioxide are having any appreciable effect on the temperature. You know, there are greenhouse gases and there are greenhouse gas effects. And carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, but it is utterly insignificant amongst the family of greenhouse gases compared to water. Water vapor traps vastly more amount of heat than carbon dioxide does.
So since we all know this and it's really straightforward, how the heck do we just stop the madness?
Well, I don't like using the phrase madness. One of the books I read recently, Cracking Big Green, the author goes off on a tangent where he uses madness or synonyms of madness in every sentence. To the people who manufacture wind turbines, this isn't madness. This is entirely logical. To wealthy landowners in Los Angeles, blocking the development of undeveloped real estate isn't madness. This is a budget issue. This is something that is quite logical. At the lower levels of the movement, you know, the monks and the monasteries of the environmentalism, you know, they have a religious attitude towards the wilderness. And they have, you know, a religious hysteria about the atmosphere and what industry is doing to it. But to the real people at the top, this is all quite logical and it makes economic sense to them.
Yeah, the foot soldiers are out there with a totally different agenda than the guys at the top. You're right. The guys at the top, it's all part of the plan.
So, one of the, you know, most damning things about the environmental movement is that the countries who are the real victims, if I had to list the top four countries who were victims of environmentalism, it would be Canada, the U.S., Australia, and Brazil. Those are countries that have vast land resources, vast natural resources. But for environmentalism, they would really be booming.
Mm-hmm.
The comparative advantage they have over Germany and Japan is cheap land, cheap resources. So if we take that away from ourselves, we are no longer nearly as competitive as they are. You know, countries like Germany and Japan, they have very little land, virtually no natural resources. So converting to an economy that is based on, you know, other than petroleum, other than coal, with a lot of recycling, etc., that is in the interest of those regions, countries which have a dearth of natural resources. You know, much of what the environmental movement has been up to lately has been this war on coal. You know, America is the Saudi Arabia of coal. America has 9,000 years supply of coal. If it was strictly a market based energy system, electrical system, almost all of American electricity would come from coal.
Sure.
It is being shut down. And this is a way to undermine America's comparative advantage.
Yeah, get rid of all the things that are cost efficient.
Well, I think you could say the same thing about oil. I mean, the United States exactly. Oil reserves.
Petroleum and coal are the number one enemies of the environmental movement. But look at a country like Germany or Japan. You know, this is in their interest. This is not irrational for those countries to promoting the environmental agenda. If we switch to electric cars, if we switch to wind turbines and solar panels, like the number one manufacturer of wind turbines is Siemens, which is a German engineering company, has over 400,000 employees. These people, it's quite logical to push this agenda, the climate agenda, which is really about moving towards renewable energies. For the companies that are manufacturing those products and the countries where those companies are headquartered, this is entirely a rational agenda. So I avoid calling the environmental movement crazy. It's quite logical from their point of view.
Yeah, just from those of us who are being ensnared by their little agenda. So what about
for an average American, not that there is such a thing, but for a more or less, you know, ordinary American to really embrace environmentalism, if you're not being employed by the Nature Conservancy, it's irrational. You are a dupe. You are a victim of propaganda, you have been indoctrinated, and you are putting forth an agenda that is in fact going to impoverish you and those around you.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the only people that really truly do benefit from the environmental movement are the people that are employed by it, and that is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
That is getting bigger and bigger.
I try to do the old thought experiments as to how many people are employed by the environmental movement, and it's not easy. You know, the American Wind Energy Association claims that there are 50,000 people employed in wind energy. There's probably about 25,000 environmental activist groups. Many of those are small groups, probably only have a handful of staff. But the Nature Conservancy has over 3,000 employees. And then you've got all these state ministries at the federal level and the state level. You know, there was that recent People's Climate March in New York City, had 300,000 people out there. This is a movement that employs definitely over 300,000 people. I mean, that's just the staff, you know, being forced to march in the parade. If the movement is that large, definitely well in excess of 300,000 people employed in the movement. There's probably up to 300,000 people employed just in the environmental activist groups. And on every college campus, you'll find faculties of environment science, faculties of environmental engineering, environmental student societies, what have you. That's one of the real powerhouses of the movement is on the university campuses. And
well,
so you've got to add those numbers up as well. You're dealing with, you know, there's probably a couple of million people who are directly economically benefiting from environmentalism or who believe once they graduate they will. There's that many people with dollar signs in their eyes who think that environmentalism is in their economic interest.
Well, it's the next big frontier. I mean, let's face it, you're manufacturing all that with wind, with batteries, with you know, all types of, you know, solar panels. They're all going to employ people in the future, and that is going to be the next big boom if we don't turn it around. Even though what's amazing is the technology still isn't there to make it economically feasible, and yet we're still charging down this road. And if it weren't for government subsidies, none of it would pencil out.
Well, it's interesting too that the kids in the college kids that are looking at these careers, because I met a kid during the election. I was at a phone bank, and this kid was making calls, and I said, "Oh, so you go to the college?" "Yeah, I do." "You know, what's your thing?" And it was like environmental science or something. I said, "Oh, what are you going to do?" He goes, "I was thinking I'd go to work for the EPA." And I'm like, I thought he was kidding. So of course I started laughing. And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, really? You know what? The devil wasn't hiring?" And the kid kind of looked at me real weird. And I said, oh, are you serious? You're going to go to work for the EPA? The kid goes, yeah. I go, why would you want to oppress your parents, your brothers, your sisters, your cousins, everybody else you know? Why would you want to do that? He goes, well, I'm very concerned about carbon, and I want to find out how we can sequester more carbon. So I told him the thing about the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I said, how do you explain that? He goes, I can't. And I said, well, you're getting a graduate degree in environmental science, and you want to work for the EPA to stop carbon pollution, and you can't explain to me how carbon doesn't kill people. So don't you think you should probably figure that out? Kid goes, yeah, you know what, I don't know. I said, yeah.
you crushed his dreams.
It was right before we left, and we were there with a high school student who had ridden down there with us, and he got in the car, and I said, so what do you think about that? He goes, I think you ruined his future. But how crazy is that?
Once he gets to the EPA and he sees his first paycheck with
all
the benefits,
good.
It'll be deleted for sure. These are good government jobs for these people. They probably wouldn't have jobs anywhere else. So it's, like I said before, it's really a mercenary movement at that level.
Yeah.
And, how many people are employed by various, parks, agencies, and what have you. It's an elaborate network, a whole archipelago of bureaucracies across America at the state, municipal, and federal levels. And every one of them is a revolving door with these environmental activist groups.
Well, you know
people.
Go ahead.
Well, people put several years in at some sort of local environmental group, but at the whole time, they've got their applications in with various, government conservancies and park services and what have you. Once you get in on there, that's the gravy train, right? It's basically a no-show job. You make, the EPA at the upper levels, it's all six-figure salaries. There's a lot of people in that constituency.
Well, isn't it funny? It used to be that back in the day, you went to work for the government because you couldn't find a job in private industry, and that was the only thing available was a government job, and you took that job, and you worked at it as long as you had to until you found a good job. And, a lot of that was based on you couldn't get a job anywhere else because you weren't qualified. But the more I'm learning, I don't think that's really changed that much, because I don't think these people are still qualified for anything else but government work.
The problem is it pays a lot, and you can't be
fired. It does.
And you can't be fired.
It
that's
pays
the
a
biggie.
Lot. They
you
got the best benefits. I mean, a government job today, boy, you're right. That's the gravy train.
Well, we just busted.
Doesn't make you qualified, though.
Busted the Benefits Administration for the VA this last week. The Inspector General's report came out, and one of the ladies who oversaw a project that had 13,000 claims that went back to the 90s, now all those claims are missing, right, and they can't account for them. Management admits they were there, but nobody knows where they are. That lady just got promoted to run another facility in another town. She's on her way to being the director of one of those agencies.
Highly qualified.
It's like, I rest my case. Okay, we've got to take a quick break. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're going to go eat more mints and happy up. We'll be right back with William K.
Boss Steakout.
Green, green, it's green they say, on the far side of the hill. Green, green, I'm going away to where the grass is greener still.
Oh, well, I told my mama on the day I was born, don't you cry when you see I'm gone. You know there ain't no woman gonna settle me down. I just gotta be traveling on. I'm singing.
Green, green, it's green they say, on the far side of the hill. Green, green, I'm going away to where the grass is greener still.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves, when I think it could be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful
than green
like that. It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like flashy sparklers on the water or stars in the sky.
Oh, Bob.
Who is this?
Oh, you don't know?
Come on.
It's Sinatra.
Was it?
That's Frank Sinatra.
Oh, my God.
Frankie.
Classic.
It ain't easy being
oh
green.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's our goal, is to make it less easy to be green.
That's right. You just want to blend
I'm
in.
I'm with Kermit the Frog, and I'm the guy with the frog in my voice right now. So.
No, Kermit did it originally.
That's what I thought.
But a lot of people, including Sinatra, redid it.
I need to get out more. That's a great one. Oh, my gosh. See, this is what happens to us when we talk about this stuff. We just get sillier and sillier and sillier, because if we don't, then we get really angry. See, and that's not
me. I get more serious the more I talk about it.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. We get more intense. And so, I don't know, we've chosen to try to have fun with it.
You know, we were talking
earlier. Because we're really angry underneath.
We were talking earlier about how this has really become an industry. The company I work for in my day job, we deal with heavy equipment. And one of the divisions that I think is the fastest growing and one of the more profitable divisions is our green industry, where we sell machines that process green waste, that process scrap, that process aluminum, all the biodegradable type stuff. I mean, there's a whole line of equipment that is being developed, and they've had it in Europe for a long time now, but it's all coming over here now to help process all of this green waste. So it is. It's big money. It's spawning a big industry. Unfortunately,
in movement politics, it's called the built constituency. If you go back to when the climate change campaign began around 1980, you know, wind power, solar power, ethanol, these were all non-existent industries. It wasn't as though the manufacturers of those products, you know, summoned the climate change campaign into being. No, other groups did that.
Mm-hmm.
But once the regulatory framework was in place where it became profitable to manufacture wind turbines and solar panels, this huge industry then emerges. Now, the industry itself is becoming one of the main lobbies. They have billions of dollars to spend. So, you know, if you compare the size of the wind industry in 1980, climate change campaign begins, to now, a dramatic change.
They
summed it into being. And back to the relationship with recycling is a prime example of the metropole versus hinterland dichotomy. The metropolitan areas do not want to be dependent on mining in the interior. They don't want those areas to develop. So it makes sense for the metropolitan areas to recycle as much as they can, even if they end up with a less quality product, even if it costs more money.
And it does
than
cost more money.
Virgin materials.
It costs a lot more money to recycle. There's no profit in that. If you didn't have a government subsidy to recycle aluminum cans, we wouldn't recycle aluminum cans, I guarantee you.
And that goes for a lot of products, paper, what have you. There's both government subsidies, there's regulations that penalize those not using recycling things. You know, I watch all these people collecting cans and what have you. All that labor is unpaid.
Sure. That's what I'm saying.
But it's a way for the cities to emancipate themselves from the hinterland. If we just let the market forces go, there'd be a lot more mining. There'd be a lot of cheap metals and products on the market. You know, recycling is something that's been imposed on us, and it's a huge waste of labor.
It's a huge waste of labor, and it's very expensive. Years ago, I sold some equipment to our local city, and I toured their recycling facility. And at that time, they told us that without the federal money that came in to build that plant and run that plant, they'd shut it down because they don't make money recycling that stuff. They get federal funds if they recycle a certain percentage of their waste. So they put up these plants, they recycle their minimum amount, they get their federal money, and that's why they do it. If the federal government didn't kick any money in, those things would shut down and it'd all go in a landfill.
Which where most of it ends up anyway, ultimately, not that that's any great tragedy. I mean, we dig metals from under the ground, we put them back under the ground. I don't think that is a sin in and of itself. But if you go to any sort of state or province or country and type in, you know, the California Recycling Industry Association, you'll get various things will pop up, and there'll be literally hundreds of little companies that are involved in recycling.
Oh, sure.
And this is a bread and butter issue for them. So it's one of the ways the green movement leverages itself and grows ever larger. You know, their regulatory sabotage of the market generates this whole rent-seeking collateral auxiliary that in many ways is larger than the movement itself.
Hmm. So we're... Yeah, we both do that.
Gosh, it's mind-boggling when you look at the dollars, though.
Yeah.
It's staggering.
Well, just to repeat what I said earlier, global renewable energy, this is annual investments exceed $200 billion a year.
Wow.
You know, the estimate is the climate change campaign is now receiving $1 billion a day.
God. So, okay, so all these, you know, vehicle miles traveled, because now they're going to punish people. You know, now they're all driving the dumb electric cars. So now
in California.
Now they got to punish them for doing that because now they don't have their gas tax to fix their roads. And you have the Associated. Have you been following this Associated Bay Area government thing down here?
No, sorry.
I just was curious because it is a, I mean, really, it's the erasure of private property. They want these nine counties to become a city state and have a seat at the UN. And their people aren't really not opposing it.
Well, what's it called? Miles traveled tax.
Yeah, the vehicle miles traveled.
Yeah, so you'll have to file on your income tax how many, you know, your odometer reading on your car, and they're going to charge you X amount of dollars per mile to drive in California, which, you know, California is, I won't say it's unique, but the California economy is really built around our freeway system. Everybody drives here. You go to New York, you can get by without a car. You go to California, you have to have a car. Unless you live, you know, in a rabbit hutch downtown and, you know, you shop at the store downstairs. You have to have a car in California. And now they're going to get their hands on miles traveled. I mean, it's a crime. It's a total crime.
So where do you think
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, that's, you know, another step in the process. It's a way to tax people. It's a way to regulate more of the economy. And of course, the environmental movement has a long-running opposition to the automobile. Not that the elites don't have fleets of cars. They really don't want to see the masses having them.
No, they're all down on the carbon footprint, but they all show up at these meetings in their private jets and their limousines and probably have a carbon footprint that's 10 times what you and I will ever have.
Well, one of the core tenets of fascist philosophy is that there should be a nobility. There should be a political elite to whom the rules do not apply. There should be two separate sets of laws. You know, in Europe, before the modern era, this was the norm. Still in countries like Britain, you've got peers and what have you.
Uh-huh.
That was the norm across Europe. And you see that deeply entrenched in the environmental movement. Time and again, you see these people who have extravagant lifestyles preaching how, you know, the masses must modify their lifestyles and cut back. But it's because in their mindset, that's acceptable. They truly believe there is going to be a nobility, there is going to be a political class.
Well, we got away from
who
that.
Who should make decisions for the entire community.
Right. And, you know, America was built because we wanted to get away from that whole thing. And here we are.
Precisely.
Lining ourselves up to get right back in the same bed we just got out of.
Are you guys, since you live in Canada, but you obviously follow the stuff that's going on in the U.S., who's in worse shape? Are we in worse shape than you guys, or are we kind of tied for down the drain?
Well, I'm not sure if we're talking exclusively about the degree to which the environmental movement has penetrated the society.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very similar. Very similar.
Well, you guys, I know you guys can harvest your timber at pretty much at will up there. We certainly can't do that. I mean, we have to produce at least in California, a timber harvest plan that could take 2 years to actually get pushed through before you cut one tree. Of course, then in Oregon, you can do it on the back of a napkin and log the next day. What do you guys do up in Canada?
It's actually quite regulated here as well. Those days of the harvesting at will are long gone. Vast areas of the best timber have been taken out of production. There's designs on even more restrictions and containments, more parks and what have you.
And why is that? When your population is so small and the landmass is so huge, why are they pushing us? Again, going back to the environmental side of it?
Oh, well, it's precisely the same thing that's happening in the Western United States. It's hard for people who are not from Canada to imagine just how big the forests are out here. The forest in British Columbia, that's the province just to the west of Alberta, would probably rival the entire size of California. That's the virgin timber.
Right. And it is huge. I've seen it. And it's immense. You can't even imagine how much there is up there that has not been harvested. And yet
don't underestimate the ability for environmentalism to, confuse people and to have them believe things that are really absurd. Many years I lived in the city of Vancouver, and it is an absolute rainforest in which it was built. It rains about 10 feet a year. It's like Seattle. It just rains all the time. And there's people in Vancouver who are convinced there's an impending water shortage.
Yeah.
And they aren't using their sprinklers in the summertime sometimes. And there's an enormous river called the Fraser River, flows by the city. We don't take one drop out of it. It's almost the size of the Nile. And yet there are people walking around in that city who are convinced that there's some sort of water shortage. I've seen it rain 30 days straight in Vancouver, but they're convinced that, that we've got to really conserve water. And they're convinced that we really have to conserve, the forest and the land, even though that, we're nibbling in Canada right now. We are harvesting annually less than 1/400 of the forest.
Jeez. Right, it's growing back faster.
We could do this for 400 years and not work our way through it.
No,
there's more old growth forest in British Columbia now than there was 100 years ago. Yet there are people who are convinced this is a scarce resource that we must somehow prevent people from accessing.
Yeah, well, prevent.
Let's not lose sight of the fact that the real controlling minds of this movement, they do know the game. They do know that the real fear is that if you let forestry companies and mining companies in there, they'll build roads, there'll be towns in no time.
Sure.
There will be a migration of people into those areas. And it's about containing people into the urban areas, and it's about preserving land costs and what have you in those urban areas.
Classic. Well,
so when it seems irrational to hear a common citizen spouting this stuff off, there's an agenda at work, which is quite rational.
Unbelievable. Well, we'll give you a chance to actually cough for just a second here. Take our last quick break, and then come back with a poor William.
A wrap.
We caught him on.
You've got to cut back on that
day.
Carbon dioxide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All that stupid carbon dioxide. Oh, I like this one. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Traded in his dumb old Ford for a new smart car with an extension cord. Now he's saving gas and got a cheaper note, but he's got no way to haul his boat. It's the little things we take for granted when we sacrifice to save the planet. Darndest thing I've ever seen. That old redneck is done gone.
That
old redneck is
done
gone green.
Wow.
Man. Makes me want to buy a smart car.
Not. Oh, my goodness.
Makes you want to tip one over.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like much work.
Kind of made me want to ram one on the way here because it was in my way. But somebody had already hit him in the bumper. He was such a bad driver. No meat. He didn't have enough zippity-doo-dah to hit the gas pedal. So, okay, in our in our final minutes with you, Mr. K, what would you like to tell people?
Well, I'd encourage them to check out my website. You can just Google Environmentalism is Fascism. There's also a lot of other pretty good websites out there from the Heartland Institute and junkscience.com. Read about it. You know, fortify yourself with some knowledge. Once you get past the point, you know, of understanding what a bunch of nonsense environmental science is, how fake it is, people will be better equipped to challenge it. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I suppose political work and cultural work that has to be done if we're ever going to, you know, turn this around. But, you know, don't lose sight that, you know, we're on the good side of this. We are really representing the broader population by far. And we're representing those people that want to move forward, that want to progress, that want to, you know, build and develop. That's who we represent. And, you know, we are the true patriots, whereas a lot of the environmentalists, I view them as really being guilty of treason. They are trying to impose an agenda that is not even from North America onto this economy. And they are, you know, whatever level of consciousness, they are doing this. And it's about being a patriot, and it's about being, you know, believing in the people around you, and trying to, you know, let your people go and develop. And we're fighting the good fight, and you really have to read up on it, and that's an important part of it.
Yeah, I've always believed there's more of us than there are of them, and but we just have to be more vocal. We have to get out there and counter what the mainstream media has bought into and what they're spewing, because I truly believe 90% of what they're saying is false. And we can back it up. Just do our homework.
Ditto that.
Well, we've got some links. I just was putting them on the page. I don't know why I didn't do it sooner. But we had junkscience.com, the Climate Depot, CFACT, Global Warming Policy Foundation, Green Corruption, What's Up With That, Green Agenda, and Friends of Science. Those are the ones you gave me. So if you send me more,
yeah,
I'll post
more.
Them.
There are, you know, there's dozens of them out there.
Cool.
You know, there really is a mass movement. We are excluded by and large from the mainstream media, and that's not an accident.
No, it's not.
The internet is a wonderful thing.
Well, we will post anything you send to us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, William, for coming on.
Touching base with us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for putting up with my croaking voice.
Sorry about that.
You guys are awesome.
Well, we loved having you. We'll do it again. We won't wait 2 years. Thanks a million.
Okay, cool.
Okay, next week, the big national town hall on technocracy. Go to the site, get your book. At the very least, tune in, wethepeopleradio.us. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM, Shasta, Redding.